Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I am the host of the podcast, Cindy Howes. Thank you so much for joining us today. Oh man, how exciting is this? Okay, so our good friend Mark Arelli is here. Hey, Mark.
Hi.
Mark is our guest host today, and we'll be speaking with the one and only Chuck Prophet. How exciting is that?
Guest host sounds so much better than fanboy, which is actually what I am of both Chuck Prophet and you and your podcast.
Wow, how are you holding it together? No one knows.
I've done pretty well for the first 20 seconds.
All right, before we get into that, let's talk about our email list. It's a once-a-month email that comes to your inbox and lets you know what's going on with Basic Folk. You can sign up for that at the link in the show notes or at basicfolk.com. Lets you know who is coming up on the podcast, who's been on recently, and also all of our most inner desires, secrets, and thoughts.
Do it. Just get on the email list.
Get on it. You can also follow us on social media. We are at Basic Folk Pod, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. And if you want, you can be a contributor and financially back the show. You can give $5 a month. You can give us $50. You can give us $1. We will take it. Link in the show notes or basicfolk.com. Thank you, because I'm good at telling people to make contributions, but I'm not good at admining. I am not a development department, but I do try. We try here. Mark Arelli, I believe you are a contributor to Basic Folk.
I am. I really do believe in this podcast. And I like to think that I would say the exact same thing, even if I hadn't been on it myself a whole bunch of times. And it's true, because I just love how it dignifies artists that are kind of below the radar to a certain extent that you wouldn't normally hear on like your everyday Fresh Air episode or something like that. So I think it's great what you're doing and happy to be a small part of it.
That's great. I'm going to take what you just said and cut it up and make it into a pitch during our fall fundraiser.
Use me.
Let's see. Okay, so Mark Arelli always has a lot of stuff going on. Your last album was Lay Your Darkness Down, released last year. Earlier this year, you and your bluegrass band Barnstar released a really great album that you and your bestie and bandmate Zachariah Hickman were on Basic Folk talking about.
Yes.
And tell us about what you're working on right now.
Well, right now I'm putting together my first ever official live album to be released next year, first half of next year. And you know, I can't tell you how many times I've come off stage over the course of like 25 years now plus and thought like that was the most amazing show. And like there was either nobody there to hear it or nobody there to record it. And, you know, it just kind of went off into the ether. And that's part of the beauty, of course, of live music. Right. But, you know, after 25 years or so, I'm like, man, it would really be great to
it's time.
For once, you know, document some of that magic that can happen. And I did some shows with the string quintet this past summer. It was something I'd been wanting to do for a while. I've used strings on my recent studio records kind of as an augmentation, I guess that's the word, sort of part in addition to the main band. And I always wanted to hear like what it would be like to have the strings just be the band. So we did a few shows. We finished up at this beautiful Shallonloo Performance Center in Rockport, Massachusetts. Gorgeous facility. We multi-tracked it. It was one of the best shows I think I've ever done in my life, and we got it on tape. artist. So
awesome.
Yeah.
And that live record's going to be coming out next year.
Yep.
Looking forward to it. And I would like to push back on it being your first live recording. I feel like I need to interject here and say you're wrong, because you did have a live recording released in the early O's, correct?
Well, there was an, I called it an official bootleg. It was called 4/2/2010, and it was a board tape from Passim of a particularly good show. So I called it an official bootleg because I didn't have the same amount of sonic control over it that I did over like a multi-tracked sort of thing.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So you're right.
Well, no, Mark, I would like to push back further and say, what about the Memorial Hall recordings?
Also technically true, recorded live, but without a studio audience. So, without a live audience. So, you know, this one has me playing live with the string quintet and people clapping and singing along and sometimes coughing annoyingly in the audience that we had to erase. But yeah, this is like the proper live record experience, and it sounded really good. I can't wait to share it with people.
Oh, man, I'm excited to hear it. And also, I just want to let you know, I am your archivist, and you cannot pull a fast one on me like that. Mark, I'm so thrilled to be presenting this interview between you and Chuck Prophet. You guys are buds. The new record that Chuck is actually... So if you're listening in real time, Chuck Prophet's new album, Wake the Dead, is coming out tomorrow. Woo. If you're not... It's out. It's out. Go listen to it. So please set us up for this interview.
Will do. Well, Chuck Prophet has been a mainstay on the indie and Americana music scene since the 1980s, before either of those designations was a common part of the rock and roll lexicon. Through his guitar work in the seminal psychedelic desert rock band Green on Red, musical collaborations with Kelly Willis, Kim Ritchie, and Warren Zevon and others, and a string of over a dozen solo records, Prophet has kind of carved out a respected niche in rock music history with his quote-unquote California noir sound. It's a streak he probably could have kept riding for the rest of his career if not for his sudden diagnosis with lymphoma a couple years ago. During his treatment and eventual recovery from cancer, Chuck found solace in his record collection, in particular, the vibrant rhythms and danceable energy of cumbia music. He eventually sought out a favorite local band in the genre to jam and then formally collaborate on Wake the Dead, his first new solo album in 4 years. The project blends his longtime band, The Mission Express, with members of the cumbia outfit Quien Sabe, and the result is equal parts familiar and fresh. It's a great record. Now, I have firsthand knowledge of Chuck Prophet's freewheeling collaborative process, having worked with him and his longtime songwriting partner, Clipshutz, on a song for my 2020 album, Blindsided. And I once taught with Chuck at a folk festival songwriting school and was so relieved to be able to play before him at the instructor open mic because no one in their right mind wants to follow Chuck Prophet on stage. His musical catalog is so deep and broad that it's both inspiring and truthfully a bit overwhelming. It was a joy to reconnect with him for a wide-ranging conversation about his new album that also touched upon his sense of humor, guitar playing techniques, surfing culture, and even his favorite Bob Seger song.
Hell yes. All right, we're going to take a listen to a clip from the title track of Chuck's new record, Wake the Dead, and then... we will get to our conversation between Mark Arelli and Chuck Prophet on Basic Folk.
And we should tell people that if you're dead, get ready to wake up, because that's going to happen.
Gonna wake the dead. Get them on their feet. Gonna count our nickels like we're counting sheep. Gonna rob from Peter to pay Paul. And that's not all. gonna teach the children a little history, but not too much now. Gonna cop a plea, gonna rob from Peter to pay Paul, and that's not all. Quiet on the set.
Chuck Prophet, I am so thrilled to be a guest interviewer here on Basic Folk. And this is my first time, and you are my first guest interviewee. So thank you for doing that. How are you doing today?
Feel pretty good. How are you?
I'm all right. It gets a little close in this office here when I have to turn the fan off.
Oh, I see.
I'm going to power through. all right, great. Well, you got all your tech stuff figured out, and I think I've got all my tech stuff figured out on this end. Mainly, I'm just concerned that I have my microphone input level low enough to accommodate all the laughing that I know you are going to make me do here.
Okay.
So I don't want to spike any meters. speaking of which, I still have a voicemail from you saved on my phone where you address me as college boy, which I will treasure forever. I still have it saved.
Where does that even come from?
Well, that's what this first question, it's kind of a softball, but we can get into it. I want to begin at the beginning with young Chuck, right? Like, I can't imagine you as anything but a Chuck, but I'm curious about how your family addressed each other. Was it someone in your family that deemed you Chuck instead of Charles? And has going by a nickname kind of had a hand in the way you interact with others as an adult?
Well, my name's Charles, yeah, and I think I'm a third or a fourth, actually. And yeah, we moved around a little bit when I was a kid. We moved to, my dad was a Chuck, or my dad had been a Charlie up till a certain point, I don't know. And we moved to Ohio for first, second, and third grade, and then when we came back to Orange County, I just remember introducing myself at school as Chuck.
So you gave yourself the designation.
Yeah, I saw my chance and I took it, you know. I just thought it was a tougher name. I still have some aunts and who call me Charles.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's funny. I come from a family where my parents were considering several different names, and they explicitly did not choose any of those names because they could have nicknames. They wanted me to just be, I guess they just wanted full control over the nomenclature. And, you know, that seemed, you know, indicative of maybe some other thing. So I was just kind of wondering, like, with a nickname, if that allowed you the freedom to kind of, you know, be your own person, or if it was something that was, you know, ascribed to you.
I just feel like I was a Chuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I can't think of you as any other way. I think you nailed it. man, you've been doing this a long time, right? Like I lost track of how to count your discography out. I'm thinking, and apologize if I'm off by a handful here, maybe four records with Green on Red. I think
Green on Red may have been about 10 records. If you count the live record and the greatest hits.
Okay. All right. I think I was going by like studio records, maybe.
Eight records.
All right. My apologies. And then 14 solo records is under your own name. Is that?
Yeah. I mean,
we're over 20.
I mean, I just finished a record. So in order to get a bio together, I did what most people do. I, you know, search the internet for old bios. Yeah. I think it's 14.
Wow.
Albums.
Wow. So, you know, you got into rock and roll, you're not that old. So you got into rock and roll at a young age with a discography like that. So I have a kind of three pronged question here. Was there music in the house growing up? What did your parents support and enthusiasm for that music or for your music kind of look like? And has that changed over time?
We had records, you know, we had, a Bread record. I mean, Charlie Rich, some cool records and a record player in the living room. I have three sisters and two of my older sisters, you know, they brought home a lot of records. So yeah, it was really, not a particularly musical household. I mean, we didn't have a piano or anything. You know, my parents didn't really
take a great interest in music or anything. You know, as far as music in the house, I mean, where I grew up, there was music in the air. I can tell you that. And a lot of radio in Los Angeles, you know, KHJ, KEZY, and then all the FM stations. And so, yeah, there was music in the air for sure. And as far as, you know, playing guitar, I was very interested in it. And my sister had a folk guitar that she brought back from CYO camp or something. You know, I did grow up in a time, in a place where I in Orange County, I tell people if you shook an orange tree, you know, five guitar players would fall out. So, you know, I had a band. I was in a band in junior high and a garage band and tried to play the hits of the day, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Now, the radio stations you mentioned, you know, the music in the air, was that a kind of like pirate radio situation as well? Were you getting stations from Mexico as well as?
Oh, no. I mean, L.A., just, you know, it was the AM stations really initially, like KHJ and KZY, and then the FM stations, KMET, KROQ. I won a record on the air. I called in and I won a Nils Lofgren record, you know, and it was a station down in Long Beach. And I told my dad what happened. He goes, "Oh yeah, yeah, I could." Well, when I won the record, they said, "Well, you got to come down and pick it up."
Right,
I'm
right.
Like, I'm 12 years old. You know, I don't, you know. So I do remember telling my dad, you know, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I can go pick that up."
Oh, that's amazing.
And he did. He did. You know, because he was in sales and marketing for Avery Label, you know, kind of a corporate gig, and I guess he was out in the field and picked it up for me, and that blew me away. To answer your question, they did not take a great deal of interest in any of their children. I mean, or what we were doing. I mean, Judd Apatow has said that, you know, there's two kinds of kids: the ones that played sports after school, and the ones that watched the daytime, you know, talk shows. So I definitely watched the daytime talk shows. I mean, it's not like I was totally uncoordinated, but, you know, I was pretty underdeveloped kid. And so, you know, that was a pretty big window into the world. But my parents, you know, they eventually broke down, and I did get like 3 months of guitar lessons from an excellent teacher when I was about 12. And it was incredible, because this guy, I was 12 years old and I had an acoustic guitar, and he totally addressed me like I was an adult, you know, and it was very strange, you know. And he said, "Oh, you know what, like on the third lesson," he goes, "Do you know what a Pentagon is?" And I said, "It's like a government thing." He goes, "No, it's a five-sided, you know, geometric, and we're going to talk today about the pentatonic scale." You know, and he explained it to me, and he showed me a couple of those boxes, you know. And, you know, I remember my sister picked me up, and we were in the car, and like I heard something like "Lay Down Sally" came on, and there was this, that I said, "That's that thing that he was talking about." you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm like, that's that thing that he was talking about. So I was really into that, you know. I didn't really consider myself a musician, but I felt like he had offered me the code, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
A way to kind of crack the code to play lead guitar.
I guess a little stint in Ohio there, as you mentioned, but otherwise California born and bred. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And still there now in San Francisco. I've seen, I love this characterization. I've seen your music described as a California noir, which I don't know if you came up with that genre or not, but that's gold. I love the name of that. Can you talk about, like, specifically your relationship to California? Like, has anything made your feelings about your home state kind of ebb and flow or change over time? Is it something that you've grown to love, or you've always loved?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up probably 20 miles inland from Huntington Beach or Newport Beach, you know, and so I was a surfer kid, and we would take the bus to the beach, and eventually my oldest sister had an apartment, and we could stash our surfboards in her garage, you know, which was, you know, unlocked, and so we would take the bus down there, skip school, go surfing. I mean, I really am a product of California in so many ways, you know, but it really wasn't until I moved into San Francisco that my life started in many ways. You know, I think my family moved from Southern California to Northern California right around the time I got my driver's license. And so, although I lived, you know, in the suburbs, I had a driver's license and I was paying attention to things, and I was, you know, I knew there were things going on. And so I came into the city and saw the Dead Kennedys early on, and, you know, saw some incredible shows at this place, the Temple Beautiful. You know, I saw like, Wall of Voodoo, you know, before they had a record deal. And they were doing, you know, I mean, they were doing Ring of Fire and Radio. They were doing that, you know, they had a sound, you know, they came out, it was a show. So, I mean, a lot of that stuff really informed me, and I knew that I wanted to be an artist. I didn't really know what that meant.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's interesting. You know, I was a little bit after that in the MTV generation, right? Where all the music was like in the TV, you know, and it was like, how do you get in the TV? There was no way to do that. Like, if you're going to live shows and you're seeing bands up on stage, like, was it a similar sort of thing for you, where you're like, how do I get up there? Like, did it seem more attainable because it was like a real life thing?
Well, there's more. Well, you know, going back when I was, 13, 14, growing up in Orange County, you know, I was playing in little garage bands, and there were older kids that, you know, were a little more evolved, and they would go into Hollywood, you know. So at a very young age, I went into Hollywood with some kids from the neighborhood, and we saw Quiet Riot playing at the Starwood. So this is not like a moment where you say, how do I get up there? It's a moment where you say, like, you know, maybe I can hang around with people like that, but there's no way that there's a place for me. Seeing Randy Rhoads play guitar, you know? So it wasn't until later when punk rock, Alejandro Escovedo says that punk rock erased the line between the stage and the audience. So when I started coming into those early punk shows that I heard about on KPFA, which is a great station here, and they had a show called the Maximum Rock and Roll Show, and these guys would play imports from England. They would play local bands that, you know, got it together enough to make a 7-inch, but there were only so many of those. So they would also play, you know, they would also play like Kinks rarities, and I was religious for that show. And then they would announce, you know, the calendar of events or whatever, you know, and that's how I heard about the Temple Beautiful. And I got some of my friends to get into my mom's car, and we went and saw, and that's when I thought to myself, you know, I kind of kept it to myself, but I did think, God, you know, maybe we could do that.
That's really cool. I mean, I there's been a lot of people that have talked about similarities between, say, punk music and folk music. And, you know, I've heard a lot of those different things, but I've never really thought about it in the way that you just described, whereas folk music is another kind of quote-unquote genre where the distinction between the performers and the audience gets kind of, you know, blurred a lot. And it does have that effect to a younger person in the audience who's, you know, wanting to get into it, of like, oh, like maybe I could hang out with those people and learn a little bit from what, you know, they're doing, and then do it myself. I felt the same thing, but coming to folk music in that way. I never thought about that before. I'm learning things here, Chuck, about myself.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that's cool about folk music is that anybody with an acoustic guitar can learn a few open chords, and you start to learn, oh, Wayfaring Stranger, you know, Heart of Gold, I can do this, let me see, you know. And so eventually you've learned these songs. Eventually, if you're completely audacious, you can get to a place where you can insert your own personal expression into that frame. That's what punk rock was. It just seemed a little more doable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. In your understanding of it, or in your experience, like for me, I think of folk music as very much like I'm adding a link to a chain. Like there's people that came before me that were doing it. There's hopefully going to be people coming after me, maybe adding to some small thing that I can contribute. Was there a similar kind of ethos for you in punk music, or did it feel like everybody was kind of making it all up kind of for themselves?
Well, San Francisco was a little bit different, I think, than other places, because so much of the scene came out of the Art Institute. You would have bands like Chrome or something that dressed up as cops and made these incredible flyers, you know. I can't really name one Chrome song, you know. But I was a little more tapped into the East Bay scene, specifically around Berserkly Records, which had Jonathan Richman and the Rubinus and Greg Kinn. And those were the bands that, you know, I would go see on the weekends. You'd see a lot of the same people at the shows. They played every weekend, it seemed like. You know, I knew the Rubinus. They seemed really grown up. And now I learned they really weren't that much older than me. But they're all like ninth grade dropouts. And they had been to England. You know, they'd had a charting song. They'd been on television. You know, they'd been in the studio. And they had put out a couple records at that point. And I just thought that was really amazing. But I didn't think of it as very attainable, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. When did it start to feel, was Green on Red when it started to feel like something that you could do / were already doing? Like, what was the entry point?
Well, I mean, I was in a band when I was 16, was in a band with these older guys. And, you know, we played all over the place and opened for like so many bands, you know. So I kind of learned the ropes. And also, I think the thing that really helped me with those guys was that we used to play the frat party circuit in Berkeley. And I mean, it just seemed like we played an endless amount of those keggers at fraternities. And we would play, you know, the Animals, Yardbirds, Them, you know, Gloria, Mystic Eyes, you know, Heartful of Soul. That's kind of how I learned songs, you know. I mean, you know, even the Beatles, you know, you learn that they didn't even write one song when they were in Hamburg.
Yeah, true. Right.
They were just learning how to do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how
learning, they were learning other people's songs, and they were learning how they were put together, and they were learning how to keep people's attention for, you know, four sets a night or whatever they did. So I consider all that stuff early on pretty valuable, really. You know, it definitely informs everything I do.
Yeah, sure. I mean, foundational experiences are foundational for a reason, you know, because you're building on them, you know, later in your life. And you know, that's a good kind of segue there to kind of move on a little bit later to kind of now. You know, I mentioned that you have a pretty extensive recorded catalog. Whenever anyone asks me where they should kind of start listening to me, I always say, well, start with the new record, because that's what I sound like now. And you, sir, are about to release a brand new record, or it may be out by the time we this episode is out, called Wake the Dead, which features members of your longtime band, The Mission Express, as well as members of a California-based cumbia group. Give me the correct pronunciation. Is it Kinsave?
Oh, Kinsave.
Okay, yeah. All right, got it. I love the record. Before we dive into it, I want to talk just a little bit about cumbia. Can you give us like a shorthand definition of the genre, its provenance, kind of as you understand it?
I think it maybe came out of Colombia or Africa or Peru. It's been around a long time. There's a lot of variations of it. Eventually, it made its way to Mexico, very popular as a kind of a dance music. You know, my record is definitely cumbia adjacent. and I was talking to this guy, Adrian Quesada of the Black Pumas. I went and visited him. I was in Austin and played him some songs and stuff. And he was very encouraging, you know. And in the end, I said, yeah, I don't really know if this is correct. He said, listen, man, just keep doing what you're doing. Don't worry about it. And for God's sakes, do not listen to the Clave police. Ignore them. So, you know, it's hard for me to define what the music is exactly.
How did you first find it? Are those kind of ethnic communities like a part of the San Francisco cultural scene? Like, is cumbia like does it have a real presence in San Francisco?
Yeah, well, there's a dance night at a club here called the Makeout Room on Saturday nights, and there's a couple excellent DJs, and this cumbia night's been going on for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20, I don't know, long time. We occasionally play the Makeout Room, and I just remember one time we played our gig, we broke down all our gear, and we were sitting around, the band was having a beer, and I was probably having Diet Coke, and it got to be a little bit, later, and the cumbia DJs had come in, and they started playing records, and it was kind of sparse, you know, the room was kind of sparse, but it started filling up, and people were dancing, you know, and my drummer, Vicente, I can remember he was showing Stephanie some dance steps. It's just some basic dance steps. And I just thought, man, this is the coolest thing ever. I don't want this night to ever end. And, you know, you hear the bass coming out of the subs, which is in a way that, you know, you don't experience at home. And yeah, that was probably my introduction. You know, songwriters are so, as a record maker and a songwriter, you know, listening to music is sometimes, I mean, I have a healthy appetite, but I can be very analytical, and this just kind of, you know, it's just let it wash over me, and that was part of it. And then later during the pandemic, I had a radio show, and so I played a lot of music from around the world, and then I got sick. I was diagnosed with stage 4 lymphoma, and I spent 6 months in treatment. And I just listened to a lot of cumbia music, and that's really how I got here with this record. And then my manager, Daniel, who has his fingers in a lot of pies, he was down at a club on Valencia Street, and this band loaded in and they were sound checking. And that's when he texted me. He's like, man, there's these guys down here, and they're playing that kind of music you like to listen to. And so I literally walked down there and saw these guys play and got friendly with them. And that's Kian Save. They're from Salinas, California, which is a farming community on the central coast here. Yeah, it's total Steinbeck territory. I got friendly with them, and they said, yeah, well, if you want to jam sometime, just come on down. We got a big house in the middle of nowhere, and we can play as loud as we want. And so I took them up on it, and ended up doing a couple gigs with them, and that led to recording this record.
That's a great story, man. I mean, I'm curious, are you the kind of guy that would always take somebody up on an offer like that, or had your recent, you know, kind of experience with cancer, had that kind of put you in more of a frame of mind to be like, screw it, I'm going to go do this. This is something that I want to explore.
Yeah, I was into it. That's all. I mean, I was just into it. I thought I would learn something. And I'm always, you know, I'm always looking to, you know, I want to, until I tap into something I'm excited about, it's hard to grind out these records. I mean, it's hard to grind them out with the same enthusiasm, you know? So that's what I'm looking for. And I'm 4 years between records. I mean, this has never happened. You know, in the Green on Red days, I swear we were making records every 9 months. I mean, it was every record was a miracle, you know, how we were able to take five cowboy chords and do that, you know, because none of us were particularly educated. And, you know, we just figured it out. We had to. If I can get like two or three songs that I'm excited about, if I can tap into that, then maybe I got a shot at making a record. And that's generally the way it's been when I look back.
Yeah, I can hear that. I mean, you know, by way of contrast or comparison, so about 20 years ago, I did a Western swing record, right? And I wrote like a bunch of songs that were very much down the middle of what I considered to be what I understood as Western swing, you know, from my limited experience with it, just being a fan. And I really wanted to get inside Western swing and see if I could be myself inside Western swing. Listening to Wake the Dead, I kind of wonder what your process there was, if there was a process, or if you were just kind of, like you say, kind of having fun and just kind of trying to interest yourself. Were you trying to add cumbia to the Chuck Prophet sound? You know, because I feel like there is a Chuck Prophet. It's my understanding of your sound is like it's this juxtaposition of this kind of carefree, real rock and roll spirit. But at least on the records, there's also this palpable focus on like these really tight arrangements and pop craftsmanship, you know, like there's synth hooks, there's guitar riffs, there's tight harmony vocals and call and response and stuff. Like, were you trying to integrate cumbia into that? Or were you trying to kind of like, sounds like you weren't trying to make a cumbia record. You wanted to see what you could take from that genre and kind of import it into your own world. Am I getting that right?
Well, I mean, the songs are Chuck Prophet songs. And I should also mention that I co-wrote most of the record with Kurt Lipschutz, but they definitely have a cumbia groove under their feet. And also when I did do those gigs with Kian Save, people first just kind of looked at us, you know, confused, but before too long, you know, everybody was dancing. And, you know, they didn't know the songs and, you know, and I thought, well, that's really powerful. That's about as cool as it gets. That's the equivalent of erasing the line between the audience and the stage. And so that's what got me off. I mean, I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to take a cumbia. I'm going to make a Chuck, you know, I don't know. You know, I thought, well, this is really going somewhere and, it's cool, you know, because I don't know that I can explain to you all the clave patterns and what makes up cumbia music, but seeing people dance for the whole set is something I can understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And so a lot of these, it sounds like maybe a lot of these songs were kind of just, you know, quote unquote, regular old Chuck, you know, clip shots compositions that then you brought to a specific band and they kind of found the cumbia or injected the cumbia kind of into them.
No. I mean, I wrote, you know, I definitely, you know, I definitely wrote the songs with those feels.
Okay, great. Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That's that was what I was trying to get at in a very long-winded way.
And then I would four track them, you know, and play bass and play the bass lines and you know, get them going on my four track and yeah.
I got my bass right behind me here. I do the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that had to have been just pretty revelatory and pretty exciting to get into this whole new sort of sonic playground, you know? I mean, I imagine.
Well, like I said, yeah, I was pretty excited about it. And there were a lot of twists and turns in the road and some things worked, some things didn't work. You know, there was, you know, took a while to get there. Took a while to get a good batch of what I call go to the head of the class songs.
Yeah, you got them, man. You got them. There's...
I mean, a lot of them got, you know, a lot of things got discarded along the way. And
yep, as it happens.
And, you know, there's songs on there that, you know, there's a song I wrote with Kim Ritchie called Red Sky Night. And Yeah, I don't really know. It might be a bolero. It might be a samba. It might be a bossa nova. You get into all that stuff, and they're all kind of sisters and cousins of each other. But it was definitely a Latin feel.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I don't want to say surprised. I was just, it was thrilling to kind of hear how the energy and the different influence that it kind of injected into, you know, what I normally think of as like a Chuck Prophet, you know, sound. There's some, I mean, it's not, I wouldn't call it like a political record, you know, by any means, but and I wouldn't say that you're like a political songwriter either, but it's not something that you shy away from. It seems like every once in a while there's something that pops up on a record here or there. Like on this one, I'm thinking maybe Sally Was a Cop. There's a little bit of an exploration of like, you know, the kind of, is it the narco sort of Mexican cartel sort of power dynamic sort of thing in that one?
Absolutely. Well, it's a bit of a photograph, really. I wrote that with Alejandro Escovedo. He recorded it. And it was really inspired by something I read, a Cormac McCarthy interview. I hope I get this right, but they asked him, well, how did you, you know, how were you able to imagine such graphic violence, you know, around the time of Blood Meridians or something? And he said, well, he says, pretty easy. I just look around and I imagine what I look around and I see where things are going. And I imagine what they'll be like in 20 years, you know? And he said, you know, 20 years ago, would you have been able to imagine, you know, beheadings on television? And no, you know? And so that really inspired this song, and that was right around the time when the rival cartels had dumped 35 bodies on the highway in front of a grammar school or something, and that worked its way into the song. So yeah, I mean, I suppose it's political, but mostly just a photograph.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're taking a photograph, I guess at any moment in time, you're bound to capture some sort of a power dynamic in play. And, you know, that's essentially political right there. I kind of love how in the political songs you've kind of done, they seem to be, there's real variation there. You know, it's not message stuff per se. There's like humor with like get off the stage kind of thing. And then there's like just that really kind of righteous, kind of raw, kind of almost hurt in a song like, is it Alex Nieto? Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah, Alex Nieto was a song. Yeah, I mean, that's a little angry, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think I love that about when you've addressed political subjects. I like how the emotions kind of come into it, whether it's the anger or the humor. It's like, it kind of helps the listener just kind of realize, you know, what's at stake, you know? Yeah, I don't know. That's not really a question. That's just a compliment.
Well, you know, I mean, the people I like to listen to are not a downer.
Yeah.
You know,
even if they're addressing political stuff.
Yeah. I saw Lucinda Williams last night and, she encored with Keep on Rocking in the Free World, you know, and you know, it gets to that verse. That's one more kid that'll never get to go to school, never get to be cool, never get to fall in love, you know? And it hurts, you know, but the song is so glorious, you know, when you come around to that chorus, you know, and she had everybody singing and yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Oh man.
So it's not a downer, you know. I mean, the content's serious, but the music is the music's just hits that hits you.
Yeah, it's rock and roll. I mean, that it's funny to hear you mention that song specifically, because, you know, in high school, I was getting really into Dylan and really into, you know, the kind of history of, like, you know, where the singer songwriter thing kind of came from. And of course, there's all those, you know, really serious, powerful, but serious songs, you know, and then Freedom, that Neil Young record came out, which is the one that has, you know, the acoustic and the electric versions of Rockin' in the Free World. And that was the first one for me that where I was like, oh, you can sing about this stuff. And it's like rock and roll, you know? And I mean, I guess Born in the USA before that maybe would have been that as well. But yeah, Rockin' in the Free World was a big one for me too. And that lesson that you mentioned of just how any kind of message that you might have is going to go over a lot easier, at least with some people, you know, when you can kind of rock out to it, you know. I mean, we're still talking about it 40 years later, you know.
Well, it's like Springsteen says, you know, it ain't no sin to be glad you're alive.
Yeah. That's such a great.
And when I hear Rockin', that's how I feel when I hear Rockin' in the Free World. I mean, I want to live, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if people would highlight that as one of Bruce's, like, political lyrics, but you're so right. It does speak to the joy and the freedom that, you know, a lot of people are struggling to attain. Yeah, I love that line too. That's amazing. You know, we talked earlier about, you know, kind of having done this for a while, you know, rock and roll lifers, like, you know, being a true believer. You know, one of the things that I understand about true believers is that they/we, I guess I would put myself in this category, always find a way to hang on to, you know, a core belief, you know, whatever it is. You know, as you've grown older in this music, in your music, you know, how has your relationship to your core musical beliefs evolved? Have you let go of some things that felt like they were no longer serving you? Or are there other convictions that you feel kind of continually compelled to kind of hold on to?
Boy, that's some lofty shit right there. I don't know how to.
Well, let's start with the first part.
I mean, I am. You know, I definitely. You know, music can be a kind of addiction, you know, and but I'm grateful for all the things that it's brought me. You know, it brought me many of the great relationships that I've had have come through music, and you know. My wife, I met through music, and you know, I don't know. I may not have been Prince Charming, but I could play. You know, and I think she liked that. Maybe.
Absolutely. Well, man, I mean that makes me think of a couple other things, but it does bring me to another question that I had been thinking about. I would love to talk just a little bit if we could about your wife, Stephanie Finch, just for a minute. She's a wonderful, you know, extremely talented and accomplished musician, singer and songwriter in her own right. But I'm kind of curious about her role in your life and music. Like, are there things that you wouldn't have had the courage to do or things that you wouldn't have seen without her and her influence or her input?
Well, I think that's worked. Well, one of the things that's been a mixed bag is that it's all been a shared experience, you know. And when I met Stephanie, I was hanging out with a group of songwriters, Patrick Winningham and Steve Yerke. And we used to play this place in the neighborhood on the weekends. And Stephanie was really great at singing harmony. And I wasn't that confident as a singer-songwriter guy, you know, and I always liked when she would sing harmony. I thought, well, I can do something good, but with her, I mean, it's pretty great. So early on, you know, we had that. And then there were a lot of, so many twists and turns in the road with things that went our way and things that didn't so much go our way. And she's really the best thing that ever happened to me, you know, but it's hard to encapsulate the things that we've been through together, you know?
Yeah. I hear you in the challenges, or at least in the complexity of going through them together. I mean, my wife is not in the arts community. So in some sense, when I have, you know, something that I'm struggling with professionally, like I can talk to her about it, but I'm the only one kind of really struggling with it professionally. You know, I guess if your partner is also, you know, part of your creative life, like that's, you have to kind of find a way through it together. And I imagine there's got to be pluses and minuses to that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of pluses and there's some minuses for sure. But you know, I think the pandemic ultimately was kind of a positive experience for us, because it was really the first time we slowed down.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I mean, when the pandemic hit, one of my earliest thoughts was, there's some people that are going to have some artists that are going to have a really hard time with this, because they need to be out there. They need to be doing their thing. They need a reason to kind of push forward. And then, you know, there's going to be the kinds of artists that are like, oh my God, thank God I can take like a moment to breathe, you know? And it's interesting. You guys had that moment to kind of slow down, and, that shit can come up then too, you know, it can be a positive thing or it can be a challenging thing too. I mean, we both got challenging health diagnoses in the pandemic, you know, lymphoma for you and a degenerative retinal disease for me. I mean, did the pandemic, did it feel like it gave you time to kind of process things a little bit more, like the heavy stuff a little bit more, or did stuff come to the fore that had always been there maybe that you hadn't had time to really think about?
Yeah, all those things, for sure. I mean, we touched on things like that we hadn't really touched on, and I think that was good.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I could be reading, I don't want to read too much into it, but one of my favorite moments on Wake the Dead comes, you know, pretty much at the end, the final track. It's a good day to be alive. It feels kind of remarkably unguarded to me. Like, you know, I don't want to say like naked is a pejorative word for some people, but I kind of feel like it's nakedly personal in a very brave way. Like it's brave to stand fully and honestly before your audience and trust that some guy in the back isn't going to yell like, bring back the fun truck. You know, we want rock and roll, Chuck, you know, it's like, but I feel like, is that what you're doing there in that song? I mean, does that feel like what you're doing, or am I getting that all wrong?
Well, I guess there's got to be some content, you know. I mean, it addresses mortality, and honestly, Mark, you know, mortality wasn't really something I spent a lot of, you know, I never really thought about the dude, and now he's everywhere, you know.
Yeah, he's blowing up.
Yeah, I see him. You know, he's running towards me.
Yeah, oh,
and so yeah, it addresses mortality in a way, and I feel good about it.
Yeah. I mean, I love the song. It's, I think it's my favorite thing, on the whole record. There's a line in there, it's a good day to be a river, right? Which, you know, I interpret as like, you know, recognizing the value of going with the flow, of accepting what can't be changed, you know, adjusting to it, moving around it. Like, this is a business that requires a lot of stubbornness and grit to survive, you know?
Which business is the music business?
I mean, life, yeah. I guess, to the business of life, but you know, the music business for sure. There's a lot of resistance and kind of raging against the dying of the light that is required. Like, how do you balance the resistance with going with the flow these days? Have you always tried to be a river and are just now kind of aging into it, or is that something that you've always kind of recognized the value of?
I don't know. It's been a gift. You know, every time I tap into something new I'm excited about, it's a bit of a gift, you know, as far as like making a living, I don't know. I've never had a job, so I must be making a living.
Yeah. You're doing well, man. You're doing well. I love it.
Well, I like playing, and you know, I've got good people around me, and I try to, you know, make the kinds of records I would want to hear. There's a lot of that these days, like the, you know, a lot of this kind of, you know, the music industry stuff, and I kind of fade out when people talk about Spotify and things. You know, I mean, honestly, I don't ever remember a time when it wasn't hard to get paid, honestly.
Sure. Yeah. 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 No, I agree. I mean, I think even just that simple kind of, you know, ultimately pure goal of like trying to make the records that you want to hear. I mean, that's a beautiful thing. That's exactly how I approach it too. And yet that I know requires, a lot of fortitude to kind of like see that stuff through, to chase it, to get to those, you know, 10 or 12 really, you know, kind of superlative tracks, and then record them and capture them in a way that, you know, feels valuable and feels like it contributes something and moves you. And then to get them, you know, get them to market, so to speak, it's not for the faint of heart. And you've done it a lot of times. So, you know, that's an inspiration to me, I have to say.
Well, I mean, it's fun for me. I mean, I don't know about inspiration, you know, on a divine level, but I know that when I'm engaged in something and, you know, wrestling a song to the ground, or then I'm that's inspiration, you know, because I'm just totally tuned out and focused on something. And that to me is the cool part.
Absolutely. I mean, speaking of songwriting, can we talk about Clippy for a sec? Kurt Lipschitz, longtime collaborator, you know, full disclosure, I guess, you know, when you listen to NPR, they say like, you know, this show is being underwritten by so-and-so. Yeah. you and I and Kurt have also written a song together, just full disclosure. But, the sense of humor in your work, I feel like you're a really funny guy, but I feel like a lot of that comes from Kurt as well. Would you agree? Is that one of his valuable contributions?
Yeah, absolutely. The two of us in a room together, I mean, we definitely make each other laugh, and that's part of it, at least.
You talked about teachers in the past and kind of how having a teacher that kind of spoke to you, you know, as an equal kind of stirred something in you. I mean, do you feel like you teach each other things for, I mean, you guys have been writing songs together for a long time. Have you been each other's teacher?
Yeah. I mean, we wrote some songs early on. We had like a 10-year gap. And then we kind of got back together, and, you know, hit the pavement. But one of the things is I have an office. And so when I go there or meet somebody there, and you've been there, then I kind of honor it. You know, I feel like, oh, we got to honor this. You know, this is a place for writing songs. It's not a place for, you know, and that's really cool. But as far as your question about teachers, I have thought about that, and that I had some great teachers. You know, I mean, Jim Dickinson, who produced a couple Green on Red records, was a, you know, I did sessions with him as well, and he was just an incredible teacher. I worked with a lot of great producers through the years, you know, Al Cooper and Brad Jones. And I feel like I've learned a lot from them, and I feel like I've sought them out. You know, Steffi and I used to play with Rolly Sally, and he's remained a dear friend, and he would play upright with us, and he had written that song "Killing the Blues," and he plays with Chris Isaak actively. You know, but we had a lot of teachers, a lot of people that yeah. I mean, I include Kurt in that. You know, he brings a lot of stuff to the party. In terms of literature and poetry and just his worldview, you know, and I have a worldview as well. And we both have our strengths. And when we get in a room together, we're able to pull songs out of the air. And, you know, Dan Penn told me, if you can do that with somebody, if you're lucky enough to find somebody you can do that with, you know, do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, you've talked about your teachers, people that taught you. Do you have any sense of filling that role yourself for, like, you know, either other peers or a younger generation? Is that something that you take seriously in any way, or is it that you recognize?
Well, sometimes when I produce, I feel that I'm kind of in that role. I mean, you want to show people different ways it can be done, help them along. But, you know, I'm not an engineer. So when I produce, I don't just lean back and say, man, listen to that kick drum, you know. I'm you know, bringing my own experience to it. And I'm thinking of the song, and I'm thinking of how the song's, you know, coming out of the speakers and how it's going to hit people. And you know, I bring that experience to when I produce. So I don't produce very often. Because, you know, it's like you end up joining the band in many ways. And, you know, it can be a great experience, you know, but it can also be an experience where you learn that, you know, you can't want it more than the artist.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. As someone who's produced a few things himself, you know, and has produced myself, you know, I felt that way about myself sometimes. Like, you know, I feel like I'm dragging my own ass across the finish line at some point. Yeah. Like, what are we doing here? You know, that brings up, you know, the question of, like, vision and artistic vision, and something that I've kind of noticed about you and just your, like, your social media posts is you seem to be a bit of a movie buff. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, can you talk, do you have a sense of how that's spilled over, or if it's spilled over into how you approach your music? I mean, is that something that comes into play with lyric writing or production in terms of, like, setting a scene, painting a picture?
Well, I just think I lived through the golden era of movies. You know, I lived through the golden era. I mean, I lived at, you know, we had a movie theater in La Habra, on Whittier Boulevard that, you know, we would go, we didn't care what was playing, you know, it wasn't a multiplex. And, you know, I saw Rocky Horror Picture Show as a first run movie. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know what I was watching. I might've even seen it twice, you know, but that's what it was like growing up in Los Angeles. And then I lived through the era, you know, of, you know, when I moved up to San Francisco, there were so many art houses. There was the Red Victorian, there's the York, the, you know, the Vogue, the Four Star, so many art houses. And, you know, me and my friends, we were just film nerds. And that continued on. And then, of course, into the 80s, you've got El Mariachi, Four Weddings and a Funeral. You got the whole Merchant Ivory. And it was a wonderful time to be alive. And so, yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of movies.
Well, I can hear it in your
songs.
I
don't know if I consider myself a, you know, an expert on anything, but yeah, saw a lot of movies, spent a lot of time sitting in the dark, a lot of matinees.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can kind of hear it in the songs, you know, this ability to kind of sketch a little scene, a little vignette, I can kind of just imagine you sitting there in the dark, you know, watching the screen, because that's kind of the experience I get listening to some of your songs, is that like the scene is just being set, you know, for you as a listener. And it struck me as like, yeah, there's probably a relationship there with the movies. Very cool. Very cool.
Well, it's hard, you know, it's hard to talk about songwriting. You know, I listen to a lot of these podcasts and it's hard, you know, I have a hard time. It weirds me out. You know, I don't really like to hear myself talk about it that much.
I get you. You know, I mean, when people ask me questions about it, a lot of times I'm like, I'm just so thrilled and honored that you think that I have any control over it. I mean, I just, on my best days, I'm just trying to sit down and be a bit of an antenna. And then when the signal stops, that's when I start kind of, you know, trying to rest whatever raw material I've been able to pick up into some kind of digestible form that moves me, you know. But I don't really personally feel in control of the process, you know, much either. So when people ask questions about it, sometimes it can be a little awkward. It's like, I don't know. I wish I did know. I would do it more often and I would do it all the time, you know?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about that. You know, my first record, much of the stuff on there, I really wrote out of necessity because, you know, we had a little group. Steffi was playing accordion. I was playing guitar and we had a sort of a revolving door of drummers and bass players. And, you know, we would get these gigs. It would be three sets a night. And so oftentimes I would, you know, write songs that were around, you know, chord changes that I like to play guitar on. And, you know, I play for 10, 15 minutes, you know, and that was something that we did. So I can't say that it was this, you know, that I pulled it out of the air. I was trying to, out of necessity, trying to, you know, write stuff we could do. And maybe there would be parts that we, you know, get part melodies we could pass back and forth and things like that.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. I mean, there's different kinds of antennas, right? I mean, there's the like conscious, you know, lyric, you know, storytelling antenna, but you know, I think the guitar is a divining rod of its own, you know, like just playing progressions that really feel good for whatever reason. Like there's something going on there too. That's worth dignifying. It's not just screwing around. I don't think, there's something coming through.
Yeah. I mean, I remember riding with Alejandro Escovedo one time and we were just, you know, shouting at the walls and playing this rudimentary two chord thing. And he goes, yeah, man, this is going to be cool when the cellos get a hold of this, you know? and, you know, at the time he had two cellists in his band. So he was, you know, he could see himself doing it and he could see the cellos having that, you know, grabbing onto that part. And, you know, there's a lot of that too in music. A lot of things you do that are kind of practical.
Yeah. Now, did you have a similar experience with the new records material? Like, are the guys from Kiansave, are they going to be out on the road with you or some subset of them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I definitely had an experience like that. We played live a few times and I could see the songs that everybody was really able to dig into. And, some just kind of got pushed aside, but, yeah, I'm taking out three of the members and augmenting it with me and a couple of the guys from the Mission Express, Vicente Rodriguez and James DePreto. And we've got a month of dates in Europe starting in November. And yeah, it's going to be...
Can't wait.
It's going to be wild.
Yeah. Oh, I'll be looking for a Boston date. I'll keep my ears open for that. Yeah, this is something I want to see live because I feel, was it recorded live in the studio or the core of it?
Yeah, we recorded as many as eight people at the same time. And we were able to do that at 25th Street Recording in Oakland. It's a big studio, a lot of isolation booths. And yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I'm at home when I'm making what Stephanie affectionately refers to as my rock pile records. You know, I'm very much at home with, you know, two guitars, bass and drums. I know what's going on at any given time, you know. But when you've got eight people playing and one guy's harmonizing another guy's part and there's percussion, two percussionists, you know, at a certain point, all I could really do is just lean in and perform the song, you know, and a lot of my arrangement control just kind of got thrown out the window.
I love it. Cause I hear both of the things. I mean, I hear those flourishes where there are like lines being doubled and harmonized with, and then I also, you know, just hear a lot of elements that kind of come in, you know, once or twice, you know, listening on headphones, and then they never happen again. It's like they were just these little, I guess, performance moments. That's so cool. I can't wait to hear how it evolves on stage too, again, because, you know, playing live in the studio and playing live in front of an audience, you know, those are not exactly the same thing by any stretch. So I'll be looking to see how the songs evolve when you get to Boston. I hope there'll be a tour date in my neighborhood.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. All right. Listen, I want to thank you so much. This is the first time I've ever done this. I have interviewed people before for my own stuff, but I've been a fan of the Basic Folk podcast for years. I've known one of the hosts, Cindy, I've known for years, and always loved the way that she took care with interviewing people. You know, I joke that she does like fresh air interviews for people that aren't probably not going to make it to fresh air for whatever reason, you know. I know I'm not. So I wanted to bring, you know, the same kind of mentality to this, and I appreciate you being my guinea pig. One thing, if Cindy were here, she would want you to play the Basic Folk Lightning Round, and I did not want you to miss out on that experience. So if you are willing, sir, I would love to do a quick kind of up or down lightning round of questions to finish up. Are you up for a lightning round?
I suppose so, if we have to.
Okay. All right. If we must. It can all be edited out later if you really feel that strongly about it. All right. Here we go. Skateboarding or surfing?
Surfing.
Okay. If you can say it in public, what is your favorite surfing spot?
Oh, at the moment, I would say Lindemar. Often referred to as the tough surfers as Lake Lindemar, but, you know, you can find me out there with the sewing circle.
Love it. All right.
The retirees and their longboards. Yeah, that's
great.
My spot.
Sounds magical. What's a song that makes you cry every time?
Tommy Womack's got a song about the Harris Teeter. I can't think of it, and it's just about running into an old flame at a Harris Teeter. And Amy Rigby's got a song called, I think it's called Don't Change, Don't Ever Change. There are others, but those have hit me out of nowhere.
Yeah, I'll have to look up that Tommy Womack song. Amy Rigby, she's a genius. Yeah, we were on the same record label for a while. All right, least favorite household chore.
Oh Christ! You know, I don't like it. Cleaning a stove is something that I'd rather just throw the whole stove
All right,
away.
Perfect. What's your most useful non-musical skill?
Well, probably writing. You know, I mean, if that's a skill. Probably, yeah. When we're having issues with the landlords, you know, Steph, you'll say, "Well, why don't you write an email?"
There you go. Sounds pretty goddamn useful. right. I'll put you out of your misery here. Final lightning round question. What is your favorite Bob Seger song?
Oh, Ramblin' Gamblin' Man. He came out of the gate. I mean, I could just loop the drum intro, you know, and be happy. For sure, you know. But when I was a child, I really liked
I think
it's called Main Street. I think that's like, it's like, you know, the 1/5/6 change, the dark end of the street change. I think it always
Man,
gets me.
Those are both my exact answers to that question, you know, for those reasons. That groove and Ramblin' Gamblin' Man is just undeniable, and Main Street just like takes you there every time. It's just an absolute, you know, epic song. So we're in agreement. You made it through to the other side of the lightning round. You survived. It's over. You're out of your misery.
Well, thanks for including me, you guys. And Cindy, thanks for including
thanks
me.
For doing
it's been too damn long.
Chuck, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate you spending some time with me.
Oh, Mark, I adore you. And I hope we can get together and do it again and play more shows together. And good luck with everything and the family and all that stuff.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can find us on FolkAlley.com and Folk Alley's mobile app, BasicFolk.com, or wherever you get podcasts.
If you like this episode, don't keep it to yourself. Don't be greedy. You should share it with a friend. Like that guy who's always telling you how amazing Tom Petty was back around like 1983. Share it with that guy because he would love Chuck Prophet.
Okay, great. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. You are very special to us. Bye.
Bye.